Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 17, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleform conference call, Little Sisters of the Poor Case Decided, Zubik v. Burwell. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that the call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our speaker, Roger Severino. He's the director of the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. Roger, thanks for being here. With that, we will turn the floor over to you.
Great. Thank you very much. Glad to be back on. This was a very interesting case that got more interesting over time with the unfortunate death of Justice Scalia. The calculus as to what would happen changed dramatically. We had interesting supplemental briefing and now a very fascinating per curiam opinion. So I'll take it in order. Coming out of Hobby Lobby, that decision where it was a 5-4 majority, it seemed as if the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was interpreted in such a way as to make the Little Sisters of the Poor case fairly clear that they were on solid ground and had strong arguments in favor of a victory on this go-around. With the loss of Justice Scalia, unfortunately, it threw it into a 4-4 split. It would have required one of the liberal justices to essentially flip their votes from Hobby Lobby in order to find in favor of the Little Sisters. It underscores just how important, for example, who's going to take Justice Scalia's spot is as an issue for our nation. So much hung on in the balance, and once it was a 4-4 split, the question was, what is going to happen now if they do split? Coming up through the circuit courts, it was the 10th Circuit, 3rd, 5th, and D.C. Circuits, which ruled in favor of the government and against the petitioners, which included the Little Sisters of the Poor and various other religious nonprofits. And the 8th Circuit was a victory for religious freedom under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That created the circuit split, and had it ended up being a 4-4 ruling, then the cases below would have stood as they were, which would have been bad for the Little Sisters of the Poor in particular, because there were so many circuit losses, where the courts found that there was no substantial burden on the religious exercise of the petitioners. The actual merits of the case had to do with whether or not the Obama administration, through its HHS contraceptive mandate, which included required coverage of abortion-inducing drugs, could first go through the plans of religious institutions, and then under various alternate enforcement mechanisms, they provided what the administration considered accommodations, whether or not those alternate enforcement mechanisms still violated the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and imposed a substantial burden on objecting religious institutions. Now, mind you, these religious institutions cared not about women's contraceptive access per se. They cared about whether or not they would be complicit in providing and facilitating abortion-inducing drugs and devices and contraceptives. So the question was really, what is the mechanism? How much involvement is the government going to require of religious institutions when it comes to coverage of insurance for these devices? The background is that the government had already exempted religious institutions in their core functions, but parachurch organizations like the Little Sisters of the Poor, not directly governed by the Catholic Church directly, these religious nonprofits were not protected through a straight exemption. So the government was already dividing the line between who counts and who doesn't. And among those who didn't count, the enforcement mechanism required the Little Sisters and these other religious nonprofits to either A, file a form that actually became a plan instrument that directed their third-party administrators to provide the contraceptive coverage, or to provide a notice directly to HHS with detailed information regarding their plan name, along with the name and contact information of any of the third-party administrators and health insurance issuers. The government said, this is just the government acting. The Little Sister said, no, you're requiring of us to be an indispensable part in this machinery because you will be using us to facilitate you hijacking our own plans, our own health plans. And whatever you call it, it is essentially a shell game. The substance of the matter is you require the religious organizations to authorize their third-party administrators to provide this coverage under the law and in reality. Interestingly, though, during oral argument, much of the debate was over whether or not there was a workable solution to this conflict. It was, in fact, vintage Justice Breyer. So Justice Breyer is known for arguing during or proposing during oral argument that maybe the parties could just work it out and find a solution. And he often wonders out loud. And apparently other justices may have been wondering the same thing given the 4-4 split, because they ordered supplemental briefing to see if there was in fact a way that the government's interest of providing contraceptive coverage for free for employees could be furthered without requiring the petitioners and the Little Sisters of the Poor to do anything other than to purchase non-contraceptive coverage for their own employees. So is there a way where the government could act independently of the Little Sisters to still provide contraceptive coverage, and all effectively the Little Sisters would ever have to do is simply raise their hand and say, I don't want any part of it? And can it be truly separate? So that was the question the court asked supplemental briefing on. Now, that in itself is highly unusual to have supplemental briefing at this level. There have been many circuit cases that had touched on exactly the how the mechanism work. The federal government had every opportunity to think about creative ways of accommodating the sisters. And in fact, they changed their alternative mechanisms about 9 times by the time all was said and done. So they kept being pushed back, and kept falling back. But then they drew the line here that we need that notice. We need that notice in order to make the coverage flow. It is an indispensable part. And the Little Sister said, you can't have us do your dirty work effectively. Those are the issues at play. That's what came out in the supplemental briefing. The government made a crucial admission. They buried it in page 14, but they said that it was an actual feasible option, that they could, in fact, find a way to provide free contraceptive coverage to the employees of religious nonprofits with nothing more than having notice of some form that the religious nonprofit objects. That's it. No direction of the third-party administrator on the part of the Little Sisters, et cetera. Simply raise your hand, object, and the government admitted that it'll be able to somehow take care of the rest. Now, it hemmed and hawed, and it said, please don't force us to do all sorts of things that didn't want to do to reach that result. But it made that admission, and the petitioners were very quick to point that out in the supplemental briefing. With those admissions came the per curiam opinion yesterday. It's short. It was read from the bench by the Chief Justice and had only 2 concurrences, and that was Ginsburg and Sotomayor. So interesting enough, you have Breyer and Kagan siding with all the conservatives and moderates without having to write separately. The substance of the opinion is also interesting. It doesn't really get into the merits at all. Now, I've heard some commentators say this is really just kicking a can down the road. It was some sort of a punt. And actually, I read 2 dueling news articles. You had one at the LA Times effectively saying this really didn't do much. It's going back to square one and contraceptive coverage is assured, which is the president's line. And on the other, you had the Wall Street Journal saying this was a great victory for the Little Sisters of the Poor and a slap for the administration. Those two are mutually exclusive positions, really. And I think, in my opinion, that the Little Sisters can rightly claim this was a big victory. And although the state of the law in terms of having a great, robust religious freedom opinion wasn't in the offing, and that was because of Justice Scalia's passing, so we didn't get that in the opinion. But what we did get was what happened on the ground. So coming into this, we had 4 circuit courts ruling against the petitioners, and the Little Sisters in particular, were facing fines of up to $70 million per year. There was a court order requiring them to comply. And if they did not, and if they followed their conscience, they would have been hit with $70 million. That was hanging over their heads. It was stayed by the Supreme Court. What the Supreme Court did here is it vacated all the lower court's decisions. So as a matter of fact, imagine as if somebody's headed to the gallows and somebody issues a stay of execution, not only that, but a retrial. Most people would call that a great victory, that where something could have been very bad and in fact was ordered to be bad turned out to be not exist anymore. And that's what vacating the opinion does. Those opinions are wiped out. And ones that had very narrow view of substantial burden under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So in terms of the effect on the law, although you don't get an affirmative opinion, it wipes away a lot of ones that really were eroding the interpretation of RFRA. So that's one thing to remember. The vacating is a very big deal, and that will affect other cases that are still working themselves up through the courts. And the second is, we covered it, the government admitted that it doesn't need the Little Sisters of the Poor and the other petitioners. It just doesn't need them to use that form. And it could find an alternate way of getting the contraceptive coverage. What that will look like in the end is why there was a remand as well, not just vacate, but they remanded it for the details to be worked out in the first instance at the bottom level. Now, some may argue, well, that still gives a chance for the administration to somehow find a way to find the Little Sisters out of compliance with the mandate and still impose something on a requirement on them to make sure that they are complicit and use their hijack their plans in some way or another. Well, they would take some real creativity, given how much briefing's been done, how many cases have gone off the chain, and the vacating of all those opinions. And I think the most important sentence in the entire per curiam opinion is the second to last. And it says, first, it says that the government has admitted that it will consider the Little Sisters of the Poor and the other petitioners as having properly objected to being required to provide contraceptive coverage through their insurance plans. So if we're talking about exemptions, protections, they've already raised their hand. And in fact, you might argue that a lawsuit is a strong form of an objection. And it really means that the requirement that they sign an additional form was never really needed as a matter of fact. I mean, that's just basic common sense, that they, in order to be notified, they didn't need that notice. They said they needed that notice in order to take the regulatory steps to take over the Little Sisters plan. Okay. The court actually said in the last sentence, and I'll quote, because the government may rely on this notice, the notice I just explained, the government may not impose taxes or penalties on petitioners for failure to provide the relevant notice. That means they do not face the $70 million per year fine. That sort of Damocles hanging over their head is gone. And the way I read this, it cannot be resurrected. This is not until the lower court holds otherwise. No, this is because the government may rely on this notice, the government may not impose these taxes. And because of that, I think it's fairly clear that the Little Sisters of the Poor are protected. The government would have to come up with something entirely new, which we have not seen before, to somehow try to reimpose that threat of the $70 million fine. So in terms of substance of the matter, it is a complete reprieve. So it's hard to call this somehow a victory for the government. I think that's just not the reality of it. They wanted to use the Little Sisters plans in the way they specified, give us this notice or else. And the court has said, no, you've gotten all the notice you're going to get, and you can't tax them for not doing anything more. You can't file a penalty to them for not doing what you want them to do. And so we see that the president's statement, and I'll quote his, he says, the practical effect is right now that women will still continue to be able to get contraception if they are getting health insurance, which is a very interesting point because it has very little to do with the opinion. The actual per curiam opinion says that the government is still able to do what it was always able to do. It could always find an alternate way to provide health care coverage with contraceptives if it wanted to. So what this is saying is essentially that the government could have reached this position 5 years ago, but it chose not to, is what this illustrates. They took the Little Sisters all the way up to the Supreme Court to fight for this signed statement, this notice, and now they cannot use that notice. They cannot force them to provide that notice. That's what the issue was at. That's what was at issue. That was precisely the relief the Little Sisters wanted, and that's precisely the relief the Little Sisters got. And you can't really spin that as a victory for the administration. And by the way, and if it was really about contraceptive coverage through health insurance, then the administration would not have exempted one out of three Americans from the mandate and from the contraceptive coverage. So it's interesting that he would take that angle, that somehow this is a victory for broad contraceptive coverage, when one out of three are exempt for various reasons, and the administration has been okay with that for several years. I'll speak a little bit about the concurrence, Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg. Again, only two of them go out of the way to say that this doesn't require the government to create a separate plan, such as like vision and dental plans. Most healthcare insurances can have these separate plans with a separate ID card where people can get it as they wish. One of the possible options that the petitioners offered was that, yes, if the government required insurers to do this separate plan with separate cards, so long as the Little Sisters and the other petitioners had nothing to do with it, nothing whatsoever, didn't fund it, didn't authorize it, didn't sign off on it, then they're okay with it. And that was effectively what they said would be a perfectly fine option. But Sotomayor, in her concurring opinion, said, well, that's actually not required by this order. Sure, it's not required by the order, correct. And is saying, and tries to go into it and say that, in fact, it would pose an obstacle to women receiving contraceptive coverage. So that detail is going to be worked out at the lower court. Clearly, Ginsburg and Sotomayor say that that option would not be sufficient in their eyes. But again, they only got two votes on that question. So it really leaves the actual future structure of compliance, even if you call it compliance anymore. It's really going to be a question of how is the government going to provide free contraceptive coverage for people who object. And with that, I will open it up for questions.
Great. Thanks for the opening remarks, Roger. In a moment, we're all going to hear a prompt that says the floor mode is on. To request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. And we're going to field the questions in the order in which they are received. So, while we wait for some questions to queue up, I think Roger, you already touched on this just a little bit, but I'll lead off with a question here. So, just generally, what effect, if any, do you think this decision will have on some of the standing cases that have yet to come before the court?
In the circuits where the decisions were vacated, then I think it was EW10 is in one circuit where the decision was vacated. They were working them. They were late to the game to get through the appeals through, so they didn't get before the Supreme Court. And there are very other organizations out there still. So those cases, if you have the order vacated above them, then it's going to go back to the district court, I think. I think there's no real other option. And they too, I think, will be shielded, so they will not have to be forced to send in a form or send in the objectionable notice that will become part of the plan instrument if they have the exact same objection as Little Sisters, which I think most of the organizations had pretty much the exact same objection. To the extent that it is the same, I think they would be treated the same in any circuit where it was actually vacated. in the circuits where it wasn't, I think it might be the Seventh Circuit with Notre Dame might have one, then I think it would have the same practical effect. And it could be just petition the Supreme Court, and then you could get the case granted, vacated, and remanded very quickly on all these issues, and just say that these cases must be remanded and decided in light of our per curiam order. And I think the fact that it was per curiam is incredibly important. This is a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court on one of the most contentious issues facing our country. This was extraordinarily controversial for years. You had nuns versus pro-choice activists, and emotions were hot. So to see it end in this way is a testament to the fact that there can be ways to diffuse these culturally tense issues where people can actually work out a solution that respects conscience. And that's the thing. The Little Sisters of the Poor did not give up on their conscience. The government had the backpedal and has found a way, and that it has admitted, where it could still provide the contraceptive coverage to women who want it for free. So if you could do that without violating the conscience of organizations and individuals, then government should do that. And that was the overarching issue behind this entire battle, was who's going to give here? Must religious liberty give to the government's interests, or must the government outweigh the religious liberty interest? And in this case, the interests weren't strong enough. Even though the court didn't issue a legal ruling to that effect, the net effect is saying that you requiring them to sign this form, I think you have to say, look what they do, even if they say nothing. The court is saying that's just not enough. You can't force the Little Sisters to violate their conscience when you yourself admit that you could do it in some other way. But by that I mean, not by their conscience, you could provide the services in some other way.
We're going to go ahead and go to the first of our audience questions. We've got a few on the line.
Hi, this is Josh Blackman. How are you doing, Roger?
Doing good.
Good. So my question is this. Originally in 2014, the Little Sisters challenged the accommodation that was published in the Federal Register. And the RFRA analysis asks, if there's a least restrictive means available, then the government loses and the challenge is over and everyone goes home. I don't understand the effect of this per curiam opinion. The proposal that the court addressed was never published in the Federal Register. If indeed this proposal works, that means the original RFRA challenge is successful and the entire case goes away. Is the court just ignoring what was actually published in the Federal Register and moving on to this new unicorn accommodation? Or, I mean, what? I don't understand. What is the lower court supposed to do with it? To pretend that the Federal Register thing doesn't count anymore? Are we just ignoring that? This has been confounding me the past 24 hours.
Yeah. Well, the goalposts have shifted. There's been 9 proposed accommodations, and each time there's been objections to what the administration has done, the administration has either issued new ruling or new clarifications, new regulations, and it's moved down and down the line. So now we have the final nub, and it all revolved around the notice and the form. And I think that's all that the Supreme Court is really talking about here, just that particular notice requirement and that particular form requirement. Because that was what would become either a plan instrument or would set everything in motion, because it would require the sisters and the other petitioners to give all sorts of information about plan type, et cetera, and would have the effect of directing their insurers to provide the coverage. Does this really mean, by this holding, that this is a least restrictive means? As a matter of fact, it really sounds like it. So I take your point that is this effectively saying there's a less restrictive means? As a matter of fact, it's hard to interpret it otherwise. Did the court say that? It didn't explicitly say that. And the concurring opinion tried to say explicitly that this is not an admission that it is a lesser restrictive means. But that only got 2 votes. That only got 2 votes. So the other justices didn't see fit to go out and say that. So by implication, that you could pretty safely say that this is the court's blessing, that this is a lesser restrictive means. No matter what the previous regulations said throughout, this would count as a way of exempting the Little Sisters of the Poor and still providing the contraceptive coverage in the future. And it's based on admission, and admissions matter. And the government admitted that it could find another way, and it's going back to the lower courts for them to find another way without getting the sisters involved.
But so, Roger, if I can ask a follow-up, wouldn't the government now have to publish this in the Federal Register and make this an actual regulation, or are we simply going to pretend the Supreme Court's order is the new status quo? Like, this doesn't absolve the fact that the initial complaint followed by the sisters and others was focusing on something in the Federal Register. We can't just pretend it didn't happen. I mean, doesn't there have to be some sort of regulatory proceedings to make this the gravamen of a new complaint, in which case all these cases must be dismissed as moot? I don't understand what are the proceedings actually going to be determining.
Yeah. So do they have to do notice and comment rulemaking to comply with this order? That's an interesting regulatory admin law question. But we've seen that this administration does all sorts of things without following the regulatory process. This ropes in other issues as to how much leeway does the administration have in issuing something like guidance. For example, this Friday, past Friday, it issued a bathroom mandate applicable to an entire country under Title IX. Now, did they follow the notice and comment process there? Well, that's going to be litigated very soon. But I think it takes a different cast when you have a Supreme Court order saying, this is what we want you to do. Do not enforce that particular regulation on these groups. And does that mean they have to issue a new regulation? I'm not sure they would. And I'm not sure the lower court would require them to in light of the Supreme Court's order.
Yeah, thank you, Roger. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for your question, Professor Blackman. We've got a few more audience questions on the line. Again, if you want to join that queue, hit the star and then the pound key on your phone, and you'll get right in line. With that, we'll go to our next caller.
Hi, Mike Norton from Colorado. As I'm reading the order, it looks to me like the Supreme Court, in its per curiam order, bought into the idea that contraceptive coverage was somehow to be provided, quote, seamlessly, close quote, through the same insurance company. And that troubles me because in the case of self-insurance, the insurance company is effectively the employer. And so you are again enforcing the employer who has religious objections to providing, somehow you're going to wind up enforcing this through the employer that has religious objections. My second question has to do with what, if any, impact will this have on others not parties to this opinion, whether they be religious nonprofits or religiously motivated for-profits?
Okay. So on the first part, the seamless question, that was really in the concurring opinion that they really brought that point forward, that it has to be seamless. And in the per curiam, they say that if the employees receive cost-free coverage from the same insurance company, the petitioners clarified that they would be okay with that, so long as they have nothing to do with their insurance company's decision. And that's where the moral calculus came in. And the broader question is, who decides that moral calculus? Does the government decide that moral calculus? Or do the religious organizations get to decide that moral calculus? And what this decision does, it takes it away from the government. And it says that we're essentially going to acknowledge that there's important interests here at stake, and we're not going to question the good faith of the petitioners. And if they're okay with their same insurance company providing coverage, and there's a way for them not to be involved, and the government admits there's a way for them not to be involved, then that should be enough. And that's really what the core of the government, the court's holding is here. If there's an alternate way, and the petitioners say, if the petitioners are saying yes, then the government should take yes for an answer. So I'm sorry,
Roger,
repeat your second question.
Yeah, let me follow up with that question, Roger. Just because in the case of self-insured plans, the insurance company, if you will, does not exist. A third-party administrator exists to administer the plan of insurance that is adopted by the employer. So the employer is effectively in the shoes of the insurance company. And I'm not sure that was recognized, actually not recognized at all, but that's my concern, is that if there is ultimately a plan that an agreement to provide contraceptive coverage through the, quote, insurance company, close quote, which equates to the employer, that creates problems. I don't know how that can be can satisfy the religious burden issues.
Right, and you're pointing out the fact that certain petitioners have separate schemes of insurance. So you have self-insured and church plans, et cetera.
Yeah.
The option there that petitioners said was, well, there's always the exchange. You set up this exchange to make contraceptive insurance coverage accessible to all Americans. You provided subsidies to many millions of Americans. So you could always have that option. Federal government can provide a system where anybody who doesn't have contraceptive coverage can go on an exchange and get contraceptive-only coverage as a supplement. And the way I read my understanding of the petitioners, they would be okay with that too, whether it's their insurance company, independent of them, does something separately, entirely separately from them, they have nothing to do with it, or if people go to the exchanges and get plans. And in fact, other states have provided the model where you have separate contraceptive-only plans that can, in fact, protect conscious rights of employers. So the model has already been done. It's already been in effect, and you should be able to simply do that with the exchanges. If the administration really wants to give people more options, more ability to get exactly the coverage they want, then they shouldn't be against opening up the exchanges to people who want this separate coverage in order to accommodate the self-insured situation.
Thank you. My second question was, to what extent, if any, can religious nonprofits and religiously motivated for-profits, not parties to this decision, rely upon the holding, particularly the holding that says fines cannot be imposed until there is a resolution?
Sure. So technically speaking, it's only these parties and these circuits that would be bound by that holding. And then there's a question of how much notice these other groups have given. And that would be a factual question based on each of the circumstances of each case. However, as I mentioned earlier, a lawsuit is a strong form of an objection. That's more than just raising your hand. It's I'm willing to fight for this as my objection. And I think there's a good argument to be made that this would apply to any court that has similar circumstances, even outside of the circuits that are covered directly by this order. That's how precedents work, and people are generally bound to the decisions, even if they're non-parties, if their facts are effectively identical. Otherwise, then they litigate it, and it goes up to the Supreme Court, and it could be granted, vacated, and remanded if they don't follow this order, and they say, just look at our per curiam order.
Thanks, Roger.
All right, our lines are wide open for audience questions right now. Again, if you want to join the queue, hit star and then the pound key on your phone, and we'll get to your questions in the order in which they're asked. Seeing no questions at the moment. Oh, here we go. Somebody just chimed in, and so we'll go directly to our caller.
This is Barbara Samuels from New York. I'm a layperson working in churches to explain religious liberty, and we've been talking a lot in churches about the Little Sisters case. And recently, we had a prayer service for the Little Sisters, and after the prayer service, the parish priest got up, and he was saying that he's appalled that the Little Sisters have stated as part of their case that they're okay with the government providing these products and services, but they don't want to be complicit in it. And I'm wondering, you know, and you said at the beginning of your statements, Roger, that the Little Sisters had no problem with the government providing these things. And we know it goes against their conscience, and they would not normally say they have no problem Were they saying that just because they wanted to make a point here that they're, I mean, why are we hearing so much of that?
Well, I do have to make a clarification on that. Thank you for raising it. There are two issues there. Well, first, I cannot speak for the Little Sisters directly because I don't represent them. So take whatever I say with a grain of salt. But what I understand of their beliefs is that they are, in fact, against widespread contraceptive use as a moral matter. So as a policy matter, I presume, as with many other religious organizations, they don't want to see government pushing abortion-inducing drugs for free to the public. Whether that's their exact position, you know, look it up online. But I have a presumption of mine. It's a separate question, however, as was argued in the Supreme Court, whether they will say that the so long as the government doesn't force them to act in violation of their conscience, then they find that their religious exercise is not burdened. So it's a separate question. One is, what is government doing universally as a matter of policy? And I'm sure the Little Sisters has many, many different views on many things the government does. I'm sure it likes some things it does, and I'm sure it doesn't like things other things it doesn't do. But the question directly under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act suit was whether the government's actions against the Little Sisters of the Poor violated their religious beliefs and forced them to violate their conscience. So it's a separate question as to whether or not they think it's a good idea or a bad idea to have contraceptive coverage versus whether they are directly made complicit in furnishing that scheme. Did that answer that question?
It did, but I just wanted to point out again the difficulty that this makes for people, lay people, non-attorneys, and so forth, following this, who have objections themselves to, you know, who are very pro-life. It makes it difficult for us to understand this when we see, like, on Fox News, and we hear you and the Little Sisters saying, we don't object to the government doing this, but we don't want to enable.
I think we may have lost her. Yes, and yeah. The distinction there is, we don't object. By that, they mean they are not forcing us to violate our conscience. That's really what that means. If they do it separately, entirely without us, they are not forcing us to violate our conscience. That's just a way of translating, we don't object. And they're almost forced to say we don't object, almost as just the way that the case was teed up. But in terms of what it means, I do get your point that, you know, there could be confusion as to where they stand on the merits, so to speak. But I think they've made it very clear that they're not taking a position in court that somehow contradicts a position on the merits of whether contraceptives, abortifacient drugs are good or bad as a moral matter.
Before we get to our next audience question, let me make a quick programming note. The next scheduled Teleform conference call is Sex and Gender Identity Under Title IX, New Guidance for Interpretation. Sponsored by our civil rights practice group. It will take place Thursday at 3:00, and the featured speaker will be Ed Whalen at the he's the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. So make sure to call into that one as well. And with that, we'll go to our next question.
Oh, hi, this is John Guzet with the John Locke Foundation in North Carolina. I'd like to go back to what an earlier questioner asked about, and that is this question of what happens to organizations that are self-insured. I've just been puzzled about this ever since the court requested its supplemental briefing, because it seems as if everybody's just sort of finessed that and not tried to come to terms with what all these compromises they're proposing. How I don't see how that's going to work. And I know you did address it, but it still seems to me this is just something that's been left out of the entire approach the court is taking to resolving this case.
Well, what the court didn't go into the details as to what it's going to look like when it remanded it down to the lower court. So it's interesting for that matter as well. It said essentially, here's what you cannot do, government. You cannot fine the Little Sisters of the Poor and the other petitioners $70 million for not complying with your required form and notice. That's the substance of what was ordered. And it says, you admitted, government, that you could find a way to provide cost-free contraceptive coverage without involving the Little Sisters of the Poor and the other petitioners. So go do it.
Well, the government didn't admit that with regard to self-insured plans, though, did it?
Well, the question presented on supplemental briefing was fairly focused on whether or not they could do it without that particular exemption notice. It didn't go into the details between self-insured and non-self-insured. It didn't go into the details of self-insured and non-self-insured. Was that intentional? I don't know. You'd have to go behind closed doors to figure that out. But as what was discussed during oral argument, they were effectively, in many ways, kind of taken together as one unit. And because the real issue is the government willing to do what it can to find a way? And during a supplemental briefing, petitioners did give options that would address the self-insured side of things, like going on the exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So the questions were addressed there, and that's an option for the government to pursue if it wants to. And from what I see here, I think it has very little choice but then to come up with something that would work. Because remember, we've gone down the line, where the government had to back off each time it proposed an alternate way of complying. And now we're down to the nub of notice and plan instruments that are triggered off the notice. And now that's effectively gone. So what is left other than now it's on the burden of the government to provide the contraceptive coverage in some other way without involving the self-insured or non-self-insured, without involving the religious institutions. I mean, that's my takeaway. And they just did not want to act as another regulatory body at this stage to specify exactly how is that going to work at the lower levels, and just left it to the district courts to take care of it in the first instance.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, we're lucky enough to have Roger on the line for another 20 minutes or so. Our lines are wide open. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, hit star and then the pound key on your phone, and you jump right to the front of the line. Seeing no questions yet, let me remind everybody again of Thursday's Teleform at 3 o'clock. That's going to be Ed Whalen discussing the new Title IX guidance. We will go to an audience call that's just come in.
Hi, Roger. One more question from Colorado. My understanding or recollection is that the Eighth Circuit struck down the most recent accommodations. This Supreme Court opinion doesn't vacate the Eighth Circuit's opinion. Any thoughts on what that might mean?
Okay. Sorry, could you repeat that?
My understanding is that the Eighth Circuit struck down the government's most recent accommodation provisions, that is, before
right.
the Little Sisters case. And the Supreme Court per curiam opinion does not vacate the Eighth Circuit opinions. What's the effect of that as you see it?
Well, that's a detail I did not notice. Thank you. So that effect would say, well, the winners win and the losers win too. So if you vacate only the losing decisions, then that's an even stronger signal that this is really trying to aim at the merits of it to protect on the ground, the facts on the ground, the winner's position, and reverse the facts on the ground, the loser's position. So in effect, to make sure that the fines don't attach to anyone. But yes, if I'll look at the opinion closest to see which ones were vacated and not. But I certainly know all the bad decisions were vacated, and that in itself changes the lay of the landscape of the law dramatically. And if I could get back quickly to the self-insurance. On the self-insurance front, the administration was already really restricted into what it could do based on ERISA law and et cetera in requiring the third-party administrators to provide coverage at all. So what the notification and signing of the form did, it would trigger an incentive for the third-party administrators to deliver the coverage that the petitioners objected to. So it's unclear as to whether they had the ability to force the TPAs to act anyway, to begin with, in the self-insured context, which just makes it doubly clear that an option like creating separate coverage in the exchanges seems like a much more logical way of doing it. If it wasn't able to do it before, it can't really do it now, that is forcing the TPAs. So in that sense, nothing has changed by the order, and that also might explain why the supplemental briefing and the order don't touch on self-insureds directly, because it may be, in fact, that the government cannot force the self-insured TPAs to provide the coverage. They could only incentivize them. And if you're in that world, the exchanges make a lot more sense.
All right. I'm going to make one last call for questions here. Again, if you have a question that you'd like to ask, hit star and then the pound key on your phone. Our lines are wide open. So we just got another. Did we? Looks like we had a caller and lost them. Here. Okay.
Hi, this is Dominique Ludvigson. Roger, thank you very much for this very informative call. So going forward for a nonprofit organization, what is the mechanism that they need to use then to raise an objection? You mentioned that it doesn't have to come to the extreme level of filing a lawsuit. So what's the procedure for them going forward for any others that find themselves in this position?
It's unclear. What the Supreme Court said is that what the Little Sisters have done counts as proper notification, and in part because the government admits that it counts as notification that they object. What else would count? I don't know. And I, of course, would hesitate to give legal advice over the phone.
Sure.
What would work. But as a practical matter, I don't know what that looks like, but I do know that at least with the Little Sisters, that the court said, given the government submission, that that is enough notice and that counts as a substantive matter. And just as a matter of common sense, you would think that that sort of objection, you know, I don't know what it would take to trigger it, but, you know, hopefully a rule of common sense would apply.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to go to at least one more call, maybe more. Again, if you'd like to join the queue, hit star and then the pound key on your phone.
This is Mark Scarberry from Pepperdine. I'm sorry I came in late, so you may already have discussed this, but do you think this, in the supplemental briefing, the plaintiffs did substantially back off from their prior claims?
No, I don't think so. I think it was always about the complicity, and the complicity was signing the form or sending the notice that would trigger and set off the plan instruments being part of the notice becoming part of the plan instrument, which then would trigger the coverage. They were an indispensable part that the government needed, and at least they said they needed until very recently. They said they needed that in order to force the infrastructure to provide the contraceptive coverage. I mean, this is infrastructure the Little Sisters paid for, selected, et cetera, and then they'd be the ones authorizing their third-party administrator to provide the coverage, and that's what they refused to do from the beginning. Now, what the government demanded of the Little Sisters changed over time, and that's true, but the petitioner's position as to what they objected to, I don't think has. I think they were consistent, saying that this is what we object to, and every time the government changed, moved the goalpost, they continued to object to it, and now the sisters are saying, so long as we're not involved, then we're okay. And the government says, okay, we can come up with a way where you are not involved. Other than simply letting us know in some way or form that you in fact object. The Little Sisters, and this came out in oral argument, they weren't ever objecting to objecting. That wasn't their position as far as I understand it. They were objecting to being drafted into the process that would end up hijacking their plans. And that is, seems to be taken off the table with this. And the whole world knows that they object to the contraceptive coverage. And so that's not the infringement of their religious liberty that they argued against. So on those grounds, I don't think they've changed positions at all.
But of course, others who object haven't done so publicly by filing lawsuits, and the insurance companies that they've arranged with to provide coverage are now going to be drafted into providing the coverage seamlessly. Now, it does seem to me the back of the form, and I've made this point elsewhere, the back of the form that HHS was requiring them to send in essentially was an instruction to their plan administrator to provide the coverage, which I thought was highly objectionable. But still, obtaining health insurance that explicitly excludes this, with the understanding that that will then trigger the government requiring the same insurance company to provide the coverage, doesn't seem to completely insulate the objectors, particularly the ones who haven't so publicly objected as have the Little Sisters and the other plaintiffs.
Well, it's what counts or doesn't count as moral complicity is for each religious institution to decide.
Absolutely.
And these petitioners have decided that if the government provides a coverage, even if it's with their own insurance plan, even if their own insurance company is required to provide some separate plan, then they do not find that their religious exercise is burdened because they have nothing to do with it. And that belief deserves respect. And that's what RFRA was all about. They pick that line, and they've been consistent in that line, that just don't require us to do it or be a part of it. And it goes back to an earlier question that was asked, how much notice now is enough? And I don't know. And that question will be decided shortly, I presume. But I would think, given the background law, that you have to give a lot of leeway to the religious institutions making the objection. So I'm familiar with civil rights law, and in civil rights law, if you wanted a reasonable accommodation for a disability, oftentimes you don't have to provide a doctor's note, et cetera, if it's obvious. And there's a basic rule of reason to accommodation requests, and you don't want to impose a burden on those seeking an exemption. You don't want to make it hyper-technical. You don't want to raise the bar. You want to make it reasonable and fairly easy. So long as the government knows that they're objecting, then you're fine. And granted, there are religious institutions, the churches effectively and closely related auxiliaries that are already exempted, and they don't have to raise their hand, so to speak. And why do the Little Sisters have to jump these extra hoops? And if to the extent they have to jump any extra hoops, then or jump a bar, the bar should be set low.
That does make perfect sense. It goes back to my prior question, though, whether their view of complicity has changed in the supplemental briefing. But certainly, whatever their view of complicity is, needs to be given very substantial deference. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no more questions, Roger, do you have any final thoughts that you might like to impart before we get wrapped up here?
Sure. And I think the big takeaway here is that even though you don't see full-throated results on the merits in terms of the law, the result in terms of the facts on the ground are enormous. When you have organizations facing $70 million in annual fines for exercising their faith, and all of a sudden, they cannot be fined $70 million per year for exercising their faith, we've had a sweeping change in the status of the law. What replaces it is what remains to be seen. But many of the threats to religious freedom in this context have now been swept away. And it doesn't mean the threats aren't going to come back in a different form. But these particular threats are gone. The particular precedents that went against the petitioners in RFRA are gone. The Little Sisters are protected from the fines. And whatever is going to happen now, the government admitted it could find a way to provide contraceptive coverage for free for women who want it. And you take and the Supreme Court is taking them at their word. Both parties is taking both parties at their word, and have left it to the lower courts to figure out exactly how the mechanism is going to happen. But at the very least, what we do know is that religious belief in this instance did win as a result of this opinion.
Great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to again thank Roger Severino for his time. Thanks also to our audience for all your great questions. Once again, just a reminder to join us on Thursday at 3 o'clock for our next teleforum as Ed Whalen discusses the Sex and Gender Identity under Title IX, New Guidance for Interpretation. That's sponsored by our Civil Rights Practice Group. Until then, we are adjourned. Thanks again, Roger.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.